You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, Lend Lease, Episode 12. This is our summer podcast spinoff of the Arsenal for Democracy radio show. This is also our final episode of the summer spinoff, which we're recording on Sunday, August 25th. We're going to be going on a hiatus of indeterminate length as my city council campaign wraps up. We're a couple weeks out now from my preliminary election, and then hopefully... going on to the November election, and you know, the future of the show in whatever form it takes will depend a lot on what the outcome of that is. So, you know, thanks for listening this summer, and please certainly bear with us, and we hope that you will return when we in some capacity or other return. We don't know yet if it'll be radio show again, continuing with a podcast or whatever. But we are back in the saddle for one more episode today. It is me, your host, Bill Humphrey, joined from Idaho on the line by Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be here.
Well, it's an unusual one. It's the Bill and Rachel Power Hour. Nate is away on vacation. And so we're going to be talking some more. Well, so we've been doing a lot of historical episodes this summer. And of course, we did the past 2 weeks. We had our two-part episode on American syndicalism and anarchism in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. We figured we would talk a little bit about some current events that were related to that to sort of close things out for the summer. Because, you know, we were just doing all this theoretical and historical overview. Now let's talk about some of the stuff we're seeing happening in practice lately. So this is an episode on largely modern day, recent syndicalist or trade unionist actions in the first world countries. We're not going to be talking about the developing countries in this episode. So we're just going to be focusing on like the United States and Europe primarily. What sort of flashes of that old time religion from the trade unions have we been seeing? So a few things that we're going to be covering today. We're going to talk about the flight attendants union and some of their actions around the government shutdown earlier this year. We're going to be talking about a Belfast shipyard, which a lot of people heard that news story. Seizing control of the shipyard. We're going to be talking about European dock workers trying to stop the war in Yemen. We're going to be talking about some union, transnational union solidarity involving labor actions around the airline Ryanair. And then we're also going to be talking, because it's in the news this week, about Bernie Sanders' plan for sectoral collective bargaining and trade union power, which is sort of a interesting proposal that came out. And then also, last but not least, we will also be talking a little bit about the Kentucky coal miners' action, taking control of a railroad down there. Rachel, let's start by talking about the Flight Attendants Union and Sarah Nelson, who has certainly become much more prominent over the course of this year as a result of the successful actions earlier this year. And I know that you have been looking into this and also following kind of some of these developments, especially, you know, her speeches to DSA and stuff like that. What do we need to know about the Flight Attendants Union and what happened earlier this year?
Yeah, so Sarah Nelson kind of pinged on my radar in January with her talk about calling for a general strike to stop the government shutdown. So there's a Jacobin magazine article kind of briefly talking about how she pretty much on her own with the union was responsible for getting the shutdown ended. So at an AFL-CIO dinner honoring Martin Luther King Jr. on January 20th of this year, Sarah Nelson called for a general strike to end Trump's shutdown. And then the following Friday, Nelson told the media that flight attendants were, quote, mobilizing immediately for a strike of their own. And just a couple hours later, President Trump agreed to provisionally reopen the government for 3 weeks. So how did she do this, basically? She knew that the air traffic controllers who were unpaid but facing felony charges if they were to strike were working, but as was legally required, but they were also taking on second and third jobs outside of those shifts to try to provide for their families when they should have been getting rest. She said, "There's going to be a breaking point here. We just could not continue to fly and ask the members to be put in harm's way. It was increasingly clear that we were open to accident or attack." And I think a lot of TSA screeners were calling out sick, so people weren't getting screened going through the lines. So there just wasn't a lot of oversight on flights, and a lot of people were overworked and overstretched and working second and third jobs. So there just wasn't a lot of the working conditions just weren't safe. And so by leveraging the flight attendants, they could definitely shut down flights. And
this would be an example of a sympathetic strike, which is something we talked about in the syndicalism episodes. You know, that this was unsuccessfully attempted during the Pullman strike in the late 19th century, where you would, you know, your specific union within this industry was not, you know, in a dispute. But you had the power to shut down the entire industry by denying your labor in support of somebody else's strike within that same industry. And that's sort of one of the ideas that that later becomes this idea of industrial unionism, syndicalist unionism, is that you would organize around industries as a whole rather than siloing yourself into a craft union alone and not paying attention to the other struggles around you.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And some of the power of the flight attendant union was kind of developed in the 80s and 90s. So as you know, in 1986, Carl Icahn fired all the TWA strikers in that year, and he showed that flight attendants could be replaced within a few days. And so the union had to be able to fight back. So they created a strike tactic called Create Havoc Around Our System, or chaos.
Cool.
Which is awesome. And the guiding principle is that the strike is going to take any form and we're not going to give you any warning. So deeply destabilizing. Corporate management has no idea what's going to happen or when. So Sarah Nelson explained, could be a single flight where there is no replacement. It could be shutting down an entire airport, or it could be everyone walking off the job for an hour. You just don't know where or when. And the effective result is that we control the schedule. An example cited was Alaskan Airlines executives were once driven to such confused desperation by chaos that they inadvertently gave many employees a 60% raise overnight. So it obviously works. The power of this union is pretty incredible and real. And Sarah Nelson has kind of created a reputation for herself that she's very serious. She's not here to play. So it was very clear to the airline industry that they were prepared to take action. Nelson also highlights the kind of power play. So Trump represents an attempt to, quote, fundamentally unravel our government. When people can't get the goods and services they need, there will be a tremendous outcry to just stop the bleeding. And if we allow it to get to that point, the White House and anyone else who has wanted to privatize all of our government functions will try to use a crisis to do exactly that. And that will lower standards. So Nelson gave the example of air traffic controllers who now have to train for 3 to 5 years to do their jobs. Private industry, in seeking that short-term profit, would have every incentive to ease those requirements, which opens up anyone in the airline industry to tremendous risk. There has to be safety regulations in place. She said, if air traffic controllers got it 99.5% right, you'd have 50 aircraft accidents a day. That's what's at stake. So by having this kind of solidarity among the industry, she is kind of propping up everybody in the industry and lending her power to prevent this privatization and these lapsing of safety regulations. So here's a pretty awesome quote. "We need to understand our power and never allow this to happen again. We need to encourage women to understand that they have power in their workplace by joining unions and running unions. We will end the wage gap that way because everyone is equal in a union contract." And when labor has that power and density, politics will reflect working people. It changes everything. Start in the workplace, she says, and the politics will follow. So after she's gotten on my radar at the beginning of the year, I've just kind of been following what she's been up to, because it's very inspiring to see what she has been doing and kind of that discussions that she sparked around solidarity and building that power as a labor movement. And I just found an article from just 4 days ago. U.S.-based Cathay Pacific Airlines flight attendants joined the Association of Flight Attendants. They voted by 99% to ratify a first contract. The three-year agreement provides immediate pay increases, back pay, schedule flexibility, and retirement security for flight attendants based in SFO, LAX, and JFK. So that's something that she's been doing to expand workers' rights to more of her comrades, I guess you could say, even in other airlines and building that power even further. So that's super exciting. There's a quote from her. "We are so excited that on our union's 74th birthday, hundreds of flight attendants are gaining the rights and benefits of a union contract for the first time. These flight attendants inspire all of us with their commitment to each other, to our union, and to our work as aviation's first responders. We congratulate the Cathay Pacific flight attendants leaders, activists, and members." So that's super inspiring. It's great that she is building solidarity to improve workers' lives all across the country. And also, there's a Nation article that's kind of talking about how she's being pushed to run for AFL-CIO leadership, or that's the rumor. She would be the first woman and first service worker to head the federation of 55 unions and more than 12 million members. Here's a quote from her. "The people who have been marginalized their whole lives have had to figure out how to make it work. You're bound to be more creative. You're bound to have less ego, because egos often get in the way of solutions. We are ripe for that leadership." So that's very exciting. And I am really looking forward to what she's going to do in the future, if she does, in fact, run for AFL-CIO leadership, because I think the current leadership isn't that inspiring. So I think it would be great to see a service worker and a woman who is kind of the changing face of the working class. Like, increasingly, the working class is more service industry oriented and majority woman. So I think the leadership in the union should reflect that.
Also, it just sort of reflects that the grassroots sentiment toward more innovative tactics and thinking outside the box and stuff like that. I feel like, we saw that with the teacher strikes and so forth and things like that, right? That some of the rank and file is more interested in, acting creatively to really take on an economic system that is breaking down and not working. And exercising that power. And, you know, as in the Jacobin article that you mentioned, right, her explaining that, like, on the one hand, you have the capitalist side and the government trying to, like, well, the specifically the aspect of the government controlled by the Trump administration and sort of the oligarchs around him, that they are trying to create artificial crises to, you know, justify privatization and so forth. But the flip side of these artificial crises is that it also creates an opportunity where, instead of the government, you know, forcing the people to say, do anything you want to stop the bleeding, the union can say, you know, can step in and say, you have to, you know, follow our terms in order to stop the bleeding, or else it's going to get substantially worse. And just sort of that sort of tactical face, I think, is interesting. I think she's been, you know, favorable toward the Green New Deal, and she's certainly gotten into it with the folks at like Politico or whatever over the Medicare for All stuff, because they intentionally tried to misquote her to make it sound like she was against Medicare for All. She's actually very in favor of it. She said that, you know, currently without it, the healthcare negotiations are some of the hardest fought and hardest won gains in any union contract, but that if you had Medicare for All, that would not happen, because everyone would have, you know, healthcare, a good quality healthcare, and then you could focus on negotiating other things like salary and benefits and things like that that cover other areas, not healthcare. Again, as usual, we'll have the article links of what we're talking about here up at arsenalfordemocracy.com, which we have done with each episode. And again, Rachel's been quoting here sections from Jacobin and The Nation and an article on the website of the Flight Attendants Union. And we should also talk now about what's going on in Europe regarding flight crews, because we're seeing some other sympathetic labor actions happening there in Belgium. And I assume we're going to see that spread as well. But I just happened to see the Reuters article on this. Rachel, do you want to talk about that as well? Or
yeah,
should I?
I can go ahead and do that. Right. So Portugal's SNPVAC union, which I'm guessing is just a flight union or a workers union. They are walking off the job to prevent the closure of bases at Girona, Gran Canaria, and Tenerife South airports. This is happening because Ryanair is choosing to cut its presence on the ground in airports due to delays in the delivery of the grounding Boeing 737 MAX. So there just isn't the need for the flight crew, I guess. So in response to Portugal's union walking off the job, Ryanair decided to ask Belgian flight crews and flight staff to work on those those potentially grounded Portuguese flights. And so they actually requested this. However, the Portuguese unions found out that this was happening and sent a letter to Belgium CNE and ACV PULS trade unions telling them not to comply with this request. The two Belgian unions are saying, so there's a quote here. Unfortunately, we had to conclude that Ryanair decided to import the conflict that is going on in Portugal to Belgium. We cannot agree with the state of affairs and will therefore call on our members to not staff these flights. So basically, you brought the fight to our house. We're not going to join you. We're actually going to join in with our union brothers and sisters. So I think it's asking unionized flight staff to basically scab. Seems like a kind of stupid move on Ryanair's part. Like, I don't know why they would ask that. I think crews in Spain and a few other countries as well are going to plan strikes for the next coming weeks and months. That's kind of the state of affairs as it stands right now. The solidarity is
critical to making this work.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And they're standing together. So obviously they have that people power against Ryanair. So it's pretty inspiring to see that we have this transnational unity and solidarity against these corporations.
Now, staying in Europe for the moment, we can talk about obviously sort of a chronic hotbed of leftism across the world has been people working around docks and shipyards, the shipyards where they make the ships, the dockyards being the people that, you know, load and unload the ships. We've got two stories out of Europe this year that show interesting sort of militant labor action, trade unionism, syndicalism, whatever you want to classify it as. We've got European dock workers responding to the war in Yemen, and also Belfast shipyard workers in Northern Ireland. So which one do you want to talk about here?
Let's talk about the Belfast shipyard workers.
All right.
So late last month in July, 130 shipbuilders, steel workers, welders, and riveters have seized control of the Belfast shipyard that built the Titanic in 1909. So they are striking, and kind of holding down the fort, until the docks are nationalized and are being used to produce renewable energy infrastructure. So the docks, shut down, after their troubled Norwegian parent company, Dolphin Drilling, failed to find a buyer. But the workers have kind of seized the site and are occupying it. It's called Harland and Wolff, the shipyard is. And they're demanding that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson which is a chilling phrase to say. They're demanding that he nationalize the shipyards and create new jobs in renewable energy there. There's a quote from a spokesperson with the union. There's massive potential in wind turbines and tidal energy. They're saying they could create thousands of jobs and that we need a just transition to renewable energy. In recent years, the workers have built parts for wind turbines, they say that renewable energy jobs would serve not only as a sustainable solution, but also a practical one because of their skill set and experience. In comparison, the Scottish government announced that it is ready and willing to nationalize a shipyard near Glasgow, where 350 jobs are at risk, which is kind of a good sign for the Harland and Wolff workers.
This article that Rachel's quoting from here is a Vice.com piece. I will note that I don't necessarily agree with their analysis after the part that you just read, Rachel. They're saying this could bode well for the Harland and Wolff workers in Belfast. I feel like no, because what we're hearing out of the United Kingdom this week is that the UK government cabinet in London working on plans to deploy English police all over Northern Ireland in the event of a no-deal Brexit. So not only is the government there not very sympathetic toward nationalizing things, unlike maybe, you know, to a greater extent the SNP is in the Scottish regional government, but we could potentially be seeing the end of home rule in Northern Ireland pretty soon. So I don't know that there's going to be a lot of support there. Certainly this would be a good idea, though. I mean, if we're taking the you know, political analysis of likelihood out of it, the Vice piece also noted that they were explicitly citing the Green New Deal and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, obviously, as Rachel just said, they had already been doing some smaller projects related to, like, turbine construction and things like that, so it's not totally out of the blue, but this idea of a Green New Deal and just transition of, you know, jobs into these green jobs, manufacturing jobs, I think they're saying that is particularly, like, inspiring to them to really push forward on this.
Right, and I think we've kind of had a narrative in the discourse that the working class doesn't care as much about climate change and this transition to green energy, but I think that people can definitely be a force for change because the government isn't doing that at this time because there's just no interest in it, in changing the status quo for them. However, the working class is definitely going to see the effects of climate change immediately, much sooner than the elite class. So it's in our best interest as the working class to push that transition to renewable energy. And kind of, I think that goes against the kind of common narrative.
And I mean, to go back to something you were talking about earlier, one of the ways in which some of the AFL-CIO leadership and some of the leadership within some of their constituent unions have alienated a lot of people lately that would be natural supporters and allies is pushing forward on things like the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access oil pipeline and, you know, complaining about the Green New Deal. And so, I mean, certainly there have been things said in favor of it, but, like, there have definitely been some of these old guard people that are reinforcing those, I think, as you say, mistaken notions, right? That this is not an issue that people care about. It's like, no, there is a potential for a massive economic transformation worldwide that could, you know, create tons and tons and tons of manufacturing jobs over a relatively short period. And you know, we'd have them for at least a few decades, certainly, I think, during this process. And the union leadership, in order to stay relevant, has to get on board with that. And we're seeing that in some cases, the militant, you know, trade unionist folks are already on board with it. And it's these old guard fuddy-duddies, you know, in places like the U.S. that are not getting on board as fast as they should be. Again, I'm not saying that that's true of everyone because there have been counterexamples, but it is, it has been an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk now about the European dock workers in a number of countries, in Belgium, in Italy. This happened earlier this year. They were trying to stop the war in Yemen, or at least not participate in contributing toward it. This is something that we also certainly saw during the decolonization struggles in French Indochina, later the U.S.-Vietnam War, probably also with the Algeria War and so forth. But, you know, we're seeing this again with Yemen. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so in May 2019, there was a Reuters article. So Italian unions were refusing to load electricity generators onto a Saudi Arabian ship with weapons on board in a protest against the war on Yemen. So the vessel loaded arms in Antwerp in Belgium earlier that month, but was prevented from picking up another consignment of weapons in the French port of Le Havre following protests by humanitarian groups. So then the boat went to Italy to load these electricity generators. Unions in Genoa tried to have the boat banned from entering the docks in the country, but the ship did end up docking there, met by a handful of protesters. So the workers refused to load the generators aboard the boat, saying that although they were registered for civilian use, they could be instead be used for the Yemen war effort. So union leaders said in a statement, "We will not be complicit in what is happening in Yemen." So they are they did allow non-critical non-war goods to be loaded onto the boat, but prevented the generators from being loaded. So I think this is encouraging because we've seen that there's not popular support for aiding this war effort at all. We've seen that in America as well as Europe. But the government has been very slow in responding to that popular opinion. And I think again, the working class and the workers are coming together in solidarity to demonstrate their power in these efforts, even if the government is actively supporting the war effort whether it be like arms or money or any other aid that is being provided to Saudi Arabia.
And there's an awareness of the global nature of the struggle, that this is not something that is limited to one country or two countries, right? That everything is tied together, especially in the age of globalization. So in that time period that we were talking about on our syndicalism episodes, the late 19th century and early 20th century, the pre-World War I period, there are plenty of researchers who have argued that that was actually a period of greater globalization than even the one we're currently in, despite, all the buzzy talk of, the world is flat type of stuff, that there was actually more sort of global trade happening and commerce happening in the, several decades prior to World War I. And I, a lot of that is certainly colonial extraction, I would say. But, even within Europe itself, there was definitely an extensive amount of trade happening there. And one of the sort of, struggle points that came up, and we talked about this a little bit with the French unions during World War I, and this was certainly true of the German unions and the Russian unions and so forth. There was a lot of pressure to, not resist the war effort on the assumption that it was very popular with the public, and would be over in a matter of months in 1914, and then you didn't want to have been on the wrong side. But the more militant factions who stood firm said, "No, this is an imperialist war, and they are hurting us as much as we are hurting them." And this is, it's that IWW slogan, "An injury to one is an injury to all," that all of this does matter, and all of this is part of an interconnected system that is keeping down the power of the working class and the ordinary people and exploiting them in these international conflicts. And that, we're still seeing that, in the Vietnam era and in today, that there is this recognition that there is this global struggle that is happening below the surface, and it occasionally manifests out in the open, but it needs to be, combated with international solidarity. I also wanted to say, I'm a little hesitant to say it just because maybe I'm not privy to the internal discussions that have happened, but one of the things that bothered me at the beginning of 2017, when the so-called Muslim ban started and there were these deportation flights that were happening, they were literally, people that had previously been allowed into the US were getting put back on return flights. They weren't allowed to leave the airport. They'd get sent back immediately. And we've also seen, with the ICE deportations in some cases being done by airline. I had a lot of trouble understanding why the flight crews were going along with this. And I will say that as a point of criticism, you know, talking about the actions of the flight attendants union and so forth, we're seeing that the tremendous power that they have, but, you know, why aren't we seeing similar actions to what we're seeing from, say, these dock workers, you know, refusing to supply the arms to the conflict, conflict in Yemen, which is basically Saudi massacring happening. Why were we not seeing flight crews refuse to participate in this? Again, maybe there were discussions about this and there was some reason why they decided that they couldn't. Obviously, they would have been putting their jobs at risk as well for various reasons. And maybe it was an issue of, you know, the government sphere versus the private sphere and so forth. But I don't really see that distinction as being as important, maybe, as has been perceived. I think that if they had wanted to, you know, airport workers could have shut down the airports. Flight crews could have refused to allow flights to take off with people that were being summarily deported and sent back. And I would like to see more of that, you know, potentially happening in the future. I can't obviously incite people to do that, and I'm not part of that. But, like, I would like to know more about why that didn't happen and whether it's a possibility, certainly. Because I think that sort of direct action can stop these things from happening. A lot of the Muslim ban stuff was partially stopped by, you know, mass protests at airports, especially on the, you know, in the East Coast, and just kind of grinding things to a halt and being disruptive in that way and drawing attention to it. But that's just members of the public for the most part rallying there. You know, what about the possibility of more direct action by the actual flight crews? Because they're not going to throw together a quick scab crew for an individual flight to take one person back to the Middle East or one person back to South America or whatever. You know, and that goes to that quote in the Jacobin article from Sarah Nelson talking about the chaos tactic of potentially shutting down, you know, one flight at a time, you know, without warning, that they can't do much about it in the moment. So you have a tremendous amount of leverage. I don't know, Rachel, if you had any thoughts about that, but that was just a comparison that kept leaping out to me as we were preparing the notes for this.
Yeah. I think there was some direct action around some of those flights, but it was spurred on by the passengers on the flights that were kind of disrupting normal operation. And I think, I don't know how successful those were, but they were definitely very sporadic and not organized, because they seemed to be very improvised, basically. And so,
yeah, I mean, it seems like they have probably about as little success as Senator D'Amato's flight uprising, where he tried to say, I'm a former United States senator, you can't keep us on the tarmac forever. You got to let us off. We're in charge of the plane now. We have rights. Everyone's just like, what? And then he got taken off the plane. Like,
yeah. So, yeah, that is some food for thought. I do wonder why there hasn't been more organized pushback against those deportation flights. So that should be interesting.
Like, I'm not expecting the Customs and Border Patrol agency's mm-hmm. union to be doing syndicalist actions against the deportations, right? They signed up explicitly mm-hmm. to do monstrous deportation actions against people. So I'm not expecting anything from them. But your average flight attendant did not, you know, get trained to be a flight attendant and dream of a career in deporting people to the Middle mm-hmm. East on a commercial flight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would like to see a statement from the flight attendant union, maybe, if they feel comfortable speaking out about it, which they probably should. So yeah, that's definitely an interesting point there.
Moving on now to another sort of infrastructural based seizure of control, direct action tactic. Let's talk about Kentucky a little bit. I don't want to go into like a huge amount of detail necessarily about it, because I want to encourage people, you know, go to SoundCloud or iTunes and look up the Trillbillies podcast episode, their bonus episode, Voices of the Harlan County Coal Blockade. They sent someone, they're a Kentucky based podcast, but they had someone go to Harlan County to interview people that were on this line. But Rachel, could you give us a little bit of context about sort of what's happening there in Kentucky?
Black Jewel, which is a company that owns this mine in Harlan County, Kentucky, suddenly declared bankruptcy. They owned mines in four states and employed over 1,000 miners in central Appalachia. So miners just learned in the middle of an afternoon shift that Black Jewel was shutting down immediately and putting everyone out of work. They did so without filing a mandatory 60-day advance warning and without posting a bond, which is required by Kentucky law to cover payroll. So all of a sudden, hundreds of miners in Harlan County found themselves without a paycheck. And so they had bills to pay. They have mortgages, car payments, medication costs, other healthcare costs, child support payments. So ex-spouses had not gotten their automatic child support payments. So lawyers representing the miners in the bankruptcy proceeding estimated that Black Jewel's employees in central Appalachia were each owed $4,202.91 on average for wages and benefits earned. In the middle of the night, basically, the Black Jewel tried to kind of sneak a train full of coal out of the mine. What began with five men just blocked the train so it couldn't leave, and so they couldn't sell the coal. So I think this trainload of coal is worth over $1 million, I believe. So the Department of Labor actually intervened during the standoff. So they asked the bankruptcy judge to block shipment of the coal, and they deemed it hot goods. So Black Jewel kind of said they would earmark proceeds from the sale of the coal for his former employees and would leave the coal where it was until there was an agreement on the amount. But the protesters say they will keep up their blockade until they have payment in hand. And this is coming from a New York Times article from earlier this month. The Bernie Sanders presidential campaign found out about this and actually sent pizza to the miners that were holding up the blockade. So that's pretty cool for the Sanders campaign to do that.
I think it's also interesting that, as the New York Times article notes, and this was certainly mentioned in the podcast episode that we referenced from the Trillbilly Workers Party podcast, there is a history of pretty militant union action in this specific area of Harlan County, Kentucky. It says, in the 1930s, efforts to organize miners led to Bloody Harlan, a deadly conflict pitting thousands of union miners against coal companies, law enforcement officials, and strikebreakers. Blood was spilled again in the early 1970s during a bitter 13-month strike by workers at the Brookside Mine, the subject of the Oscar-winning documentary Harlan County, USA. And then it said there had been little in the way of organized labor protests in Harlan for years before that July afternoon, the five miners began blocking the railroad tracks. I would note, however, though, and this came through in the interviews that they were doing on that podcast, you can say, oh, the 70s, that was a while ago. But I mean, it's what, 40 or so years at this point, 45 years. And before that, in the 1930s, that would have been probably about the same, 35 or so, 40 years earlier. And I think that it probably helps that it's not a longer gap than that. Like, there's definitely not quite institutional memory, but maybe social memory in the area of like, yeah, sometimes you just have to go and like take the power yourself and, take action to get what you're owed. And that was sort of a recurring theme in all those interviews, is that they weren't, because the New York Times is like, oh, they're just, the employees are just one party fighting alongside Black Jewel's other creditors over pieces of the company in federal bankruptcy court. And it's like, yeah, but these guys already did the work to get the coal out. And they're just trying to get what they're owed, the amount that they worked and the pay according to that, right? And a lot of these folks didn't even realize it was happening, and money was coming out of their accounts, and then it's just they don't have any money coming in. And there were, in some cases, also the company had been kind of doing some shenanigans, I think, where people thought that there was maybe more money in their accounts than there actually was, or that they had various benefits and stuff, and that's all disappeared. So it's all up in smoke. So interesting strategy there to block the railroad track and prevent the delivery of the train, because the coal's been paid for, but eventually the people that it was sold to are going to get pretty antsy about why hasn't the coal actually arrived. And that would potentially put some pressure on the company to pay up the workers. Let's talk. You mentioned about Bernie Sanders delivering pizza to the strikers. Let's close this out. Obviously, we don't have time this week, and this is our last episode of the summer, to talk about the huge Green New Deal package that was rolled out by the Bernie Sanders campaign. But less discussed, I think, was his significant and fairly sweeping proposal to create sector-wide collective bargaining and increase trade union power in the United States. So there's a Bloomberg article going over this. Rachel, talk to me about the details here of what we're looking at in this labor platform.
So, yeah, this is a very ambitious platform and very inspiring. Basically includes ending at-will employment, so companies could no longer fire workers without showing they had, quote, just cause, extending collective bargaining rights to state and local government employees and allowing federal employees to strike, and also create a European-style sectoral collective bargaining system in which labor and management would negotiate minimum standards for entire industries rather than only company by company, which is very exciting. It brings together a bigger pool of workers to the negotiation table. So that's very exciting.
Well, and this was also sort of Europe, especially Northern Europe's answer to the challenge raised by syndicalist unions and so forth. Was that the unions are saying, let's organize entire industries along, one industrial line, and we can, work together with tremendous power. And the sort of social democratic, not third way, but, almost third way, like, response to this was to say the government is the neutral third party arbiter between the industry owners and the industry workers, and that we will negotiate sector-wide agreements that cover an entire industry and say this is the minimum standard for the entire industry. That's very common in places like Denmark, in places like post-war Germany, in most of the other Scandinavian countries and so forth. It's also common in other places certainly as well, but this was sort of the European, that when you hear the phrase European socialism or European social democracy, a lot of that has to do with this codifying into laws these industrial sector-wide collective bargaining agreements. And that even covers people that aren't in unions, which is absolutely critical as well.
It would also halt by executive order pension benefit cuts that were made possible by a 2014 compromise signed into law by President Obama, whose Vice President Joe Biden is now the Democratic frontrunner. I don't think I was previously aware of this, and I know Joe Biden is basically running on Obama's coattails, and I think that's probably a losing strategy because the shine is kind of dulled over the past 4 years, and we see that Obama's presidency and administration wasn't quite as hopeful and changey as we were expecting.
Even believed at the time it was happening.
Yeah, exactly. So definitely getting rid of those pension benefit cuts would be amazing. Sanders previously called the compromise a middle of the night deal and an outrage. So that's pretty impressive that he's just kind of, I think the kind of current, Democratic presidential candidate strategy is kind of, kind of almost attacking Obama's legacy and saying that it's not quite as great as they tried to make it out to be. So it's kind of interesting to see how these candidates are discussing the legacy left by President Obama. So the proposal also includes requirements that companies would recognize unions once the majority of workers sign cards, abolish state right to work laws that prohibit mandatory union fees, ban mandatory workplace anti-union meetings, make it harder for companies to claim their workers are independent contractors rather than employees, and protect workers' jobs during work stoppages. So that's huge. I know I currently live in a right to work state. Union membership is abysmal here. So seeing kind of reversing that right to work status would be very encouraging and very inspiring. And I think union membership would probably go up at that point, at least in Idaho and other right to work states. And the the requirement that companies recognize unions once the majority workers sign cards. Right now, companies really drag their feet and don't recognize the union until they are forced to, basically. So I think getting negotiations underway a lot faster would be definitely a great thing. Banning the mandatory workplace anti-union meetings. We've all heard about like Target and Walmart and those other kind of big box stores and their anti-union videos and posters and meetings that just really kind of try to push into people's heads that the union is bad, and union leadership is just trying to line their pockets basically and not help the average worker. So getting rid of that propaganda is a great thing. Making it harder for companies to claim workers are independent contractors rather than employees. I know Uber and Lyft and the other like app companies are definitely trying to get away from providing benefits and fair labor practices to their employees because they're claiming that they're independent contractors rather than employees. So that would be a huge thing as well, especially now that the service industry has kind of taken over the economy at this point. So getting those workers protected is great, and protecting the workers' jobs during work stoppages. As we mentioned earlier, the TWA workers in the 80s were just fired summarily, so preventing that from happening, also a great thing. So this bill has been co-sponsored in the Senate by rival presidential candidates Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, and Kirsten Gillibrand, and it would reverse key provisions of the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, which is considered by some scholars and union activists to have played a major role in organized labor's decline. So it's high time that we fight back and kind of grasp some of that power that's been taken away from us over the past few decades. So this is very, very encouraging.
Very exciting stuff. Yeah, down with Taft-Hartley.
Yeah.
Well, that probably is about enough on that, and time to wrap up, I think, right?
Yeah.
So, any sort of closing thoughts on any of this, tying together all these threads, any reflections on the summer as a whole, Rachel?
I really enjoyed this series, kind of taking that deep dive into labor history was really fun to do. And also, it taught me a lot that just doesn't really get taught in like high school or even college class history classes. So I think there should probably be a curriculum of labor history, if not in colleges and universities. I think there should be maybe more of a people's history class, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed it as well. I feel like I learned plenty of things and, you know, had the opportunity to, you know, read up on some really exciting stuff. And it's kind of cool to, like, look back at the stuff from then and see sort of little flashes of parallel things happening now that, you know, are potentially interesting avenues for further development and exploration. Certainly wish we could, you know, keep plugging away on these shows. You know, if our listeners want to suggest things to talk about later when we come back, which again, we're not quite sure yet exactly when that will be, but we do plan on coming back later on. If you want to send us your suggestions, that would be certainly great. Probably the easiest way is to tweet at us at AFD Radio. I think, you know, there's other ways to get in touch with us as well, which you can figure out. But, you know, we're certainly open to ideas, and we've certainly appreciated your feedback over the course of the summer. Rachel, thank you so much for being on this week's episode, and also so many of the episodes over the course of the summer.
Thanks, Bill. It's been a great pleasure.
And again, recapping in case somebody zoned out at the beginning of the episode, this is our last episode of the Lendlease Summer Podcast series. And we're going on indefinite hiatus until the end of my current city council election campaign. So either September or November. And then after that, we'll have to figure out what the next steps and next plans for Arsenal for Democracy are. I've been your host, your lead host, Bill Humphrey. And thanks so much for listening to us this summer.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.